Mom? That groan again. The apartment was dim. The day had grown dark very suddenly, and now there was thick thunder and the sound of rain had swelled. The living room window was half open, the white curtains bellying out over the table, then being sucked back through the opening and into the air shaft beyond. There was a glistening wet patch on the floor where the rain had come in. Mom, where are you? A louder groan. He went through into the kitchen, and thunder rumbled again. He almost tripped over her because she was lying on the floor, half in and half out of her bedroom. Mom, Jesus, Mom! She tried to roll over at the sound of his voice, but only her head could move, pivoting on the chin, coming to rest on the left cheek. Her breathing was stertorous and clogged with phlegm. But the worst thing, the thing he never forgot, was the way her visible eye rolled up to see him, like the eye of a hog in a slaughtering pen. Her face was bright with fever.
Larry?
Going to put you on your bed, Mom. He bent, locking his knees fiercely against the trembling that wanted to start up in them, and got her in his arms. Her housecoat fell open, revealing a wash-faded nightgown and fish-belly white legs sewn with puffy blue varicose veins. Her heat was immense. That terrified him. No one could remain so hot and live. Her brains must be frying in her head. As if to prove this, she said querulously,
Larry, go get your father. He's in the bar.
Be quiet, he said, distraught. Just be quiet and go to sleep, Mom.
He's in the bar with that photographer,
she said shrilly into the palpable afternoon darkness, and thunder cracked viciously outside. Larry's body felt as if it was coated with slowly running cold slime. A cool breeze was moving through the apartment, coming from the half-open window in the living room. As if in response to it, Alice began to shiver, and the flesh of her arms humped up in goose flesh. Her teeth clicked. Her face was a full moon in the bedroom's semi-darkness. Larry scrambled the covers down, put her legs in, and pulled the blankets up to her chin. Still, she shivered helplessly, making the top blanket quiver and shake. Her face was dry and sweating.
You go tell him I said come out of there, she cried,
and then was silent, except for the heavy bronchial sound of her breathing. He went back into the living room, approached the telephone, then detoured around it. He shut the window with a bang and then went back to the phone. The books were on a shelf underneath the little table it sat on. He looked up the number of Mercy Hospital and dialed it while more thunder cracked outside. A stroke of lightning turned the window he just closed into a blue and white X-ray plate. In the bedroom, his mother screamed breathlessly, chilling his blood. The phone rang once. There was a buzzing sound, then a click. A mechanically bright voice said, "This is a recording made at Mercy General Hospital. At the time of your call, all circuits are busy. If you will hold, your call will be taken as soon as possible. Thank you. This is a recording made at Mercy General Hospital. At the time of your call..."
"We put them up, heads downstairs," his mother cried out.
Thunder rolled.
"Those Puerto Ricans don't know nothing."
"Call will be taken as soon as..."
He thumped the phone down and stood over it, sweating. What kind of goddamn hospital was that where you got a fucking recorded announcement? What was going on there? Larry decided to go down and see if Mr. Freeman could watch her while he got over to the hospital. Or should he call a private ambulance? Christ, how come nobody knew about these things when they had to? Why didn't they teach it in school? In the bedroom, his mother's laborious breathing went on and on. "I'll be back," he muttered, and went to the door. He was scared, terrified for her, but underneath another voice was saying things like, "These things always happen to me," and, "Why did it have to happen just after I got the good news?" And most despicable of all, "How bad is this going to screw up my plans? How many things am I going to have to change around?" He hated that voice, wished it would die a quick, nasty death, but it just went on and on. He ran down the stairs to Mr. Freeman's apartment, and thunder boomed through the dark clouds. As he reached the first floor landing, the door blew open, and a curtain of rain swept in. Chapter 15. Stu Redmond was frightened. He looked out the barred window of his new room in Stovington, Vermont, and what he saw was a small town far below, miniature gas station signs and some sort of mill, a main street, a river, the turnpike, and beyond the turnpike, the granite backbone of far western New England, the Green Mountains. He was frightened because this was more like a jail cell than a hospital room. He was frightened because Denninger was gone. He hadn't seen Denninger since the whole crazy three-ring circus moved from Atlanta to here. Dietz was gone, too. Stu thought that maybe Denninger and Dietz were sick, perhaps dead already. Somebody had slipped. Either that, or the disease that Charles D. Campion had brought to Arnett was a lot more communicable than anyone had guessed. Either way, the integrity of the Atlanta Plague Center had been breached, and Stu thought that everyone who had been there was now getting a chance to do a little first-hand research on the virus they had been studying. They still did tests on him here, but they seemed desultory. The schedule had become slipshod. Results were scrawled down, and he had a suspicion that someone looked at them cursorily, shook his head, and dumped them in the nearest shredder. That wasn't even the worst. The worst was the guns. The nurses who came in to take blood or spit or urine were now always accompanied by a soldier in a white suit, and the soldier had a gun in a plastic baggie. The baggie was fastened over the wrist of the soldier's right gauntlet. The gun was an Army Issue 45, and Stu had no doubt that if he tried any of the games he had tried with Dietz, the 45 would tear the end of the baggie into smoking, burning shreds, and Stu Redmond would cease to exist. If they were just going through the motions now, then he had become expendable. He was under detention. He had watched the 6 o'clock news very carefully, as he did every night now. The men who had attempted the coup in India had been branded outside agitators and shot. The police were still looking for the person or persons who had blown a power station in Laramie, Wyoming yesterday. The Supreme Court had decided 6-3 that known homosexuals could not be fired from civil service jobs. And for the first time, there had been a whisper of other things. AEC officials in Miller County, Arkansas, had denied there was any chance of a reactor meltdown. The atomic power plant in the small town of Falk, about 30 miles from the Texas border, had been plagued with minor circuitry problems in the equipment that controlled the pile's cooling cycle, but there was no cause for alarm. The Army units in that area were merely a precautionary measure. Stu wondered what precautions the Army could take if the Falk reactor did indeed melt down. He thought the Army might be in southwestern Arkansas for other reasons altogether. Falk wasn't all that far from Arnett. Another item reported that an East Coast flu epidemic seemed to be in the early stages. The Russian strain, nothing to really worry about except for the very old and the very young. A tired New York City doctor was interviewed in a hallway of Brooklyn's Mercy Hospital. He said the flu was exceptionally tenacious for Russian A, and he urged viewers to get flu boosters. Then he suddenly started to say something else, but the sound cut off, and you could see only his lips moving. The picture cut back to the newscaster in the studio, who said, "There have been some reported deaths in New York as a result of this latest flu outbreak, but contributing causes such as urban pollution and emphysema have also been present in most of those fatal cases. Government health officials emphasize that this is Russian A flu, not the more dangerous swine flu. In the meantime, old advice is good advice, the doctors say. Stay in bed, get lots of rest, drink fluids, and take aspirin for the fever." The sun was touching the horizon now, tinting it a gold that would turn to red and fading orange soon enough. The nights were the worst. They had flown him to a part of the country that was alien to him. In this early summer season, the amount of green he could see from his window seemed abnormal, excessive, a little scary. He had no friends. As far as he knew, all the people who had been on the plane with him when it flew from Braintree to Atlanta were now dead. He was surrounded by unfriendly automatons who took his blood and pointed revolvers at him. He was afraid for his life, although he still felt fine and had begun to believe that he wasn't going to catch it, whatever it was. Thoughtfully, Stu wondered if it would be possible to escape from here. Chapter 16. When Creighton came in on June 24th, He found Starkey looking at the monitors, his hands behind his back. He could see the old man's West Point ring glittering on his right hand, and he felt a wave of pity for him. Starkey had been cruising on pills for 10 days, and he was close to the inevitable crash. But, Creighton thought, if his suspicion about the phone call was correct, the crash had already occurred. "Len," Starkey said, as if surprised. "Good of you to come in." "Donata," Creighton said with a slight smile. "You know who that was on the phone?" "It was really him, then?" "The old Georgia giant himself. I've been relieved. The clodhopper relieved me, Len. Of course, I knew it was coming, but it still hurts. Hurts like hell. It hurts coming from that grinning, glad-handing sack of shit." Len Creighton nodded. The night that man had been elected had been a night of horror for him and for all thinking men. "Well," Starkey said, passing a hand over his face, "it's done anyway. You're in charge now. He wants you in Washington as soon as you can get there. He'll have you on the carpet and he'll chew your ass to a bloody rag, but you just stand there and yes, sir, him and take it. We've salvaged what we can. It's enough. I'm convinced it's enough. If so, this country ought to get down on its knees to you." Starkey waved it away. "One thing is top priority. You've got to see Jack Cleveland, first chance you get. He knows who we've got behind both curtains, iron and bamboo. He knows how to get in touch with them, and he won't stick at what has to be done. He'll know it'll have to be quick."
"I don't understand, Billy."
"We have to assume the worst," Starkey said. And a queer grin came over his face. It lifted his upper lip and made it wrinkle like the snout of a dog protecting a farmyard. He pointed a finger at the sheets of yellow flimsy on the table. "It's out of control now. It's popped up in Oregon, Nebraska, Louisiana, Florida, tentative cases in Mexico and Chile. When we lost Atlanta, we lost the 3 men best equipped to deal with the problem. We're getting exactly nowhere with Stuart Redmond. Did you know they actually injected him with the blue virus? He thought it was a sedative. He killed it, and no one has the slightest idea how. If we had 6 weeks, we might be able to turn the trick. But we don't. The flu story is the best one, but it is imperative, imperative, that the other side never sees this as an artificial situation created in America. It might give them ideas. Cleveland has between 8 and 20 men and women in the USSR and between 5 and 10 in each of the European satellite countries. Not even I know how many he has in Red China." Starkey's mouth was trembling again. "When you see Cleveland this afternoon, all you need tell him is, Rome falls. You won't forget?" "No," Len said. His lips felt curiously cold. "But do you really expect that they'll do it, those men and women?" "Our people got those vials 1 week ago. They believe they contain radioactive trace particles to be charted by our sky cruise satellites. That's all they need to know, isn't it, Len?" "Yes, Billy." "And if things do go from bad to worse, no one will ever know. Project Blue was uninfiltrated to the very end, we're sure of that. A new virus, a mutation. Our opposite numbers may suspect, but there won't be time enough. Share and share alike, Len." "Yes." Starkey was looking at the monitors again. "My daughter gave me a book of poems some years ago by a man named Yeats. She said every military man should read Yeats. I think it was her idea of a joke. You ever heard of Yeats, Len?" "I think so," Creighton said, considering and rejecting the idea of telling Starkey the man's name was pronounced Yeats. "I read every line," Starkey said as he peered into the silent cafeteria, "mostly because she thought I wouldn't. It's a mistake to become too predictable. I didn't understand much of it. I believe the man must have been crazy, but I read it. Funny poetry. Didn't always rhyme. But there was one poem in that book that I've never been able to get out of my mind. It seemed as if that man was describing everything I dedicated my life to. Its hopelessness, its damned nobility. He said that things fall apart. The center doesn't hold. Things get flaky, Len. That's what he meant. Yeats knew that even if he didn't know anything else. "Yes, sir," Creighton said quietly. "The end of it gave me goosebumps the first time I read it, and it still does. I've got that part by heart. What rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born." Creighton stood silent. He had nothing to say. "The rough beast is on its way," Starkey said, turning around. He was weeping and grinning. "Things are falling apart. The job is to hold as much as you can for as long as you can." "Yes, sir," Creighton said. And for the first time, he felt the sting of tears in his own eyes. "Yes, Billy." Chapter 17. Randall Flagg, the dark man, strode south on U.S. 51, listening to the night sounds that pressed close on both sides of this narrow road that would take him sooner or later out of Idaho and into Nevada. From Nevada, he might go anywhere. It was his country, and none knew or loved it better. He knew where the roads went, and he walked them at night. Now, an hour before dawn, he was somewhere between Grassmere and Riddle, west of Twin Falls, still north of the Duck Valley Reservation that spreads across two states. He walked rapidly, run-down boot heels clocking against the paved surface of the road, and if car lights showed on the horizon, he faded back and back, down over the soft shoulder to the high grass where the night bugs make their homes. And the car would pass him, the driver perhaps feeling a slight chill, as if he had driven through an air pocket, his sleeping wife and children stirring uneasily, as if all had been touched with a bad dream at the same instant. He walked south, south on U.S. 51, the worn heels of his sharp-toed cowboy boots clocking on the pavement. A tall man with no age, in faded, pegged jeans, and a denim jacket. His pockets were stuffed with 50 different kinds of conflicting literature. When this man handed you a tract, you took it no matter what the subject. The dangers of atomic power plants, the role played by the international Jewish cartel in the overthrow of friendly governments, the CIA, the Farm Workers Union, the Jehovah's Witnesses. If you can answer these 10 questions, yes, you have been saved. The Blacks for Militant Equality, the Code of the Klan. He had them all and more, too. There was a button on each breast of his denim jacket. On the right, a yellow smile face. On the left, a pig wearing a policeman's cap. The legend was written beneath in a sentence. "How's your pork?" He moved on, not pausing, not slowing, but alive to the night. His eyes seemed almost frantic with the night's possibilities. There was a Boy Scouts of America knapsack on his back, old and battered. There was a dark hilarity in his face, and perhaps in his heart, too, you would think. And you would be right. It was the face of a hatefully happy man, a face that radiated a horrible, handsome warmth, a face to make water glasses shatter in the hands of tired truck stop waitresses, to make small children crash their trikes into board fences and then run wailing to their mommies with stake-shaped splinters sticking out of their knees. It was a face guaranteed to make barroom arguments over batting averages turn bloody. He moved on south, somewhere on U.S. 51 between Grassmere and Riddle, now closer to Nevada. Soon he would camp and sleep the day away, waking up as evening drew on. He would read as his supper cooked over a small, smokeless campfire, it didn't matter what, words from some battered and coverless paperback novel. And after supper he would walk south on this excellent two-lane highway cutting through this godforsaken wilderness, watching and smelling and listening as the climate grew more arid, strangling everything down to sagebrush and tumbleweed, watching as the mountains began to poke out of the earth like dinosaur bones. By dawn tomorrow or the day after that, he would pass into Nevada, striking Owyhee first, and then Mountain City, and in Mountain City there was a man named Christopher Bradenton who would see that he had a clean car. With a car, the country would come alive in all its glorious possibilities. A body politic with its network of roads embedded in its skin like marvelous capillaries, ready to take him, the dark speck of foreign matter, anywhere. He hammered along, arms swinging by his sides. He was known, well known, along the highways in hiding that are traveled by the poor and the mad, by the professional revolutionaries and by those who have been taught to hate so well that their hate shows on their faces like hare lips. They are unwelcome except by others like them, who welcome them to cheap rooms with slogans and posters on the walls, to basements where lengths of sawed-off pipe are held in padded vices while they're stuffed with high explosives, to back rooms where lunatic plans are laid, to kill a cabinet member, to kidnap the child of a visiting dignitary, or to break into a boardroom meeting of Standard Oil with grenades and machine guns and murder in the name of the people. He was known there, and even the maddest of them could only look at his dark and grinning face at an oblique angle. The women he took to bed with him, even if they had reduced intercourse to something as casual as getting a snack from the refrigerator, accepted him with a stiffening of the body, a turning away of the countenance. Sometimes they accepted him with tears. They took him the way they might take a ram with golden eyes or a black dog. And when it was done, they were cold. So cold, it seemed impossible they could ever be warm again. When he walked into a meeting, the hysterical babble ceased. The backbiting, recriminations, accusations, the ideological rhetoric. For a moment there would be dead silence, and they would start to turn to him, and then turn away, as if he had come to them with some old and terrible engine of destruction cradled in his arms, something 1,000 times worse than the plastic explosive made in the basement labs of renegade chemistry students, or the black market arms obtained from some greedy army post supply sergeant. It seemed that he had come to them with a device gone rusty with blood and packed for centuries in the cosmoline of screams, but now ready again, carried to their meeting like some infernal gift, a birthday cake with nitroglycerin candles. And when the talk began again, it would be rational and disciplined as madmen can make it, and things would be agreed upon. He rocked along, his feet easy in the boots, which were comfortably sprung in all the right places. His feet and these boots were old lovers. Christopher Bradenton in Mountain City knew him as Richard Fry. Bradenton was a conductor on one of the underground railway systems by which fugitives moved. 6 different organizations, from the Weathermen to the Guevara Brigade, saw that Bradenton had money. He was a poet who sometimes taught free university classes or traveled in the western states of Utah, Nevada, and Arizona, speaking to high school English classes, stunning middle-class boys and girls, he hoped, with the news that poetry was an unquiet corpse. He was in his 40s now, but Bradenton had been dismissed from one California college 15 years ago for getting too chummy with the SDS. He had been busted in the Great Chicago Pig Convention of 1968, formed his ties to one radical group after another, first embracing the craziness of these groups, then being swallowed whole. The dark man walked and smiled. Bradenton represented just one end of one conduit, and there were thousands of them. The pipes the crazies moved through, carrying their books and bombs. The pipes were interconnected, the signposts disguised but readable to the initiate. In New York, he was known as Robert Frank, and his claim that he was a black man had never been disputed, although his skin was very light. He and a black veteran of Nam, the black vet had more than enough hate to make up for his missing left leg, had offed 6 cops in New York and New Jersey. In Georgia, he was Ramsey Forrest, a distant descendant of Nathan Bedford Forrest, and in his white sheet he had participated in 2 rapes, a castration, and the burning of a nigger shanty town. But that had been long ago, in the early 60s, during the first civil rights surge. He sometimes thought that he might have been born in that strife. He certainly could not remember much that had happened to him before that, except that he came originally from Nebraska, and that he had once attended high school classes with a red-haired, bandy-legged boy named Charles Starkweather. He remembered the civil rights marches of 1960 and 61 better, the beatings, the night rides, the churches that had exploded as if some miracle inside them had grown too big to be contained. He remembered drifting down to New Orleans in 1962 and meeting a demented young man who was handing out tracts urging America to leave Cuba alone. That man had been a certain Mr. Oswald, and he had taken some of Oswald's tracts, and he still had a couple, very old and crumpled, in one of his many pockets. He had sat on 100 different committees of responsibility. He had walked in demonstrations against the same 12 companies on 100 different college campuses. He wrote the questions that most discomfited those in power when they came to lecture, but he never asked the questions himself, because they might have seen his grinning, burning face as some cause for alarm and fled from the podium. Likewise, he never spoke at rallies because the microphones would scream with hysterical feedback and circuits would blow. But he had written speeches for those who did speak, and on several occasions those speeches had ended in riots, overturned cars, student strike votes, and violent demonstrations. For a while in the early 70s, he had been acquainted with a man named Donald DeFries, and had suggested that DeFries take the name Sank. He had helped lay plans that resulted in the kidnapping of an heiress, and it had been he who suggested that the heiress be made crazy instead of ransomed. He had left the small Los Angeles house where DeFries and the others had fried not 20 minutes before the police had arrived. He slunk away up the street, his bulging and dusty boots clocking on the pavement, a fiery grin on his face that made mothers grab up their children and pull them into the house. And later, when a few tattered remnants of the group were swept up, all they knew was that there had been someone else associated with the group, maybe someone important, maybe just a hanger-on, a man of no age, a man who was sometimes called the walkin' dude. He strode on at a steady, ground-eating pace. 2 days ago, he had been in Laramie, Wyoming, part of an Ekatage group that had blown a power station. Today, he was on U.S. 51, between Grassmere and Riddle, on his way to Mountain City. Tomorrow he would be somewhere else. And he was happier than he had ever been, because he stopped. Because something was coming. He could feel it, almost taste it on the night air. He could taste it, a sooty hot taste that came from everywhere, as if God was planning a cookout and all of civilization was going to be the barbecue. His time of transfiguration was at hand. He was going to be born for the second time. He was going to be squeezed out of the laboring cunt of some great sand-colored beast that even now lay in the throes of its contractions, its legs moving slowly as the birth blood gushed, its sun-hot eyes glaring into the emptiness. He had been born when times changed, and the times were going to change again. It was in the wind of this soft Idaho evening. It was almost time to be reborn. He knew. Why else could he suddenly do magic? Chapter 18. Lloyd Henry, who had been tagged the baby-faced unrepentant killer by the Phoenix papers, was led down the hallway of the Phoenix Municipal Jail's maximum security wing by two guards. One of them had a runny nose, and they both looked sour. The wing's other occupants were giving Lloyd their version of a ticker tape parade. In Max, he was a celebrity.
"Hey, Henry'd. Go to, boy. Tell the D.A. if he lets me walk, I won't let you hurt him. Rock steady, Henry'd. Right on, brother, right on, right on, right on."
Lloyd grinned happily. He was dazzled by his new fame. It sure wasn't much like Brownsville had been. When you got to be a heavy hitter, you got some respect. They went through a doorway and a double-barred electric gate. He was frisked again, the guard with the cold breathing heavily through his mouth as if he had just run up a flight of stairs. Then they walked him through a metal detector for good measure, probably to make sure he didn't have something crammed up his ass. "Okay," the guard with the runny nose said, and another guard waved them on. They walked down another hall, this one painted an industrial green. At the far end, another guard was standing in front of a closed door. The door had one small window, hardly more than a loophole, with wire embedded in the glass. "Why do jails always smell so pissy?" Lloyd asked, just to make conversation. "I mean, even the places where no guys are locked up, it smells pissy. You guys maybe do it in the corners?" He snickered at the thought, which was really pretty comical. "Shut up, killer," the guard with the cold said.
"You don't look so good," Lloyd said. "You ought to be home in bed."
"Shut up," the other said. Lloyd shut up. That's what happened when you tried to talk to these guys. It was his experience that the class of prison corrections officers had no class. "Hi, scumbag," the door guard said.
"How you doing, fuckface?"
Lloyd responded smartly. It was nothing like a little friendly repartee to freshen you right up. You're going to lose a tooth for that, the door guard said. Hey, now listen, you can't... Would you care to try for two teeth, barf bag? Lloyd was silent. That's okay, then, the door guard said. Just one tooth. You fellas can take him in. Smiling a little, the guard with the cold opened the door, and the other led Lloyd inside, where his court-appointed lawyer was sitting at a metal table, looking at papers from his briefcase. Here's your man, counselor. The lawyer looked up. He was hardly old enough to be shaving yet, Lloyd judged, but what the hell? Beggars couldn't be choosers. They had him cold-cocked anyway, and Lloyd figured to get 20 years or so. Thank you very... That guy, Lloyd said, pointing to the door guard, he called me a scumbag. And when I said something back to him, he said he was going to have some guy knock out one of my teeth. How's that for police brutality? The lawyer passed a hand over his face. Any truth to that? He asked the door guard. The door guard rolled his eyes in a burlesque, my God, can you believe it, gesture. These guys, counselor, he said, they should write for TV. I said hi, he said hi, that was it. That's a fucking lie, Lloyd said dramatically. I keep my opinions to myself, the guard said stonily. I'm sure you do, the lawyer said, but I believe I'll count Mr. Henreid's teeth before I leave. A slight angry discomfiture passed over the guard's face, and he exchanged a glance with the two that had brought Lloyd in. Lloyd smiled. Maybe the kid was okay at that. The last two CAs he'd had were old hacks. One of them had come into court lugging a colostomy bag. Could you believe that? A fucking colostomy bag? The old hacks didn't give a shit for you. Plead and leave, that was their motto. But maybe this guy could get him a straight 10 armed robbery. Maybe even time served. It was with such pleasant thoughts dancing through his head like sugar plums that Lloyd sat down to conference with his lawyer. He was in the exercise yard later that morning watching a softball game and mulling over everything his lawyer had told him when a large inmate named Mathers came over and yanked him to his feet. Mathers' head was shaved bald, a la Telly Savalas, and it gleamed benignly in the hot desert air. Now wait, Lloyd said. My lawyer counted every one of my teeth, so if you... Yeah, that's what Shockley told me, said Mathers. So he told me to... His knee came up squarely in Lloyd's crotch, and the sudden pain was so excruciating he couldn't even scream. He collapsed in a hunching, writhing pile, clutching his testicles. After a while, who knew how long, he was able to look up. Mathers was still looking at him, bald head gleaming. The guards were looking elsewhere. Lloyd moaned and writhed, a red-hot ball of lead in his belly. Nothing personal, Mathers said sincerely. Myself, I hope you make out. The law's a bitch. He strode away, and Lloyd saw the door guard standing atop a ramp in the truck-loading bay on the other side of the yard. His thumbs were hooked in his belt, and he was grinning at Lloyd. When he saw that he had Lloyd's complete undivided attention, the door guard gave him the finger. Mathers strolled over, and the door guard tossed him a package of Pall Malls. Mathers sketched a salute and walked away. Lloyd Henreid lay on the ground, knees drawn up to his chest, hands clutching his cramping belly, and the lawyer's words echoed in his brain. It's a tough old world, Lloyd, a tough old world. Chapter 19. Nick Andros pushed aside one of the curtains and looked out into the street. From here, on the second story of the late John Baker's house, you could see all of downtown Shoyo by looking left, and by looking right, you could see Route 63 going out of town. Main Street was utterly deserted. The shades of the business establishments were drawn. A sick-looking dog sat in the middle of the road, head down, sides bellowsing, white foam dripping from its muzzle to the heat-shimmering pavement. In the gutter half a block down, another dog lay dead. The woman behind him moaned in a low, guttural way, but Nick did not hear her. He closed the curtain, rubbed his eyes for a moment, and then went to the woman who had awakened. Jane Baker was bundled up with blankets because she had been cold a couple of hours ago. Now sweat was streaming from her face, and she had kicked off the blankets. He saw with embarrassment that she had sweated her thin nightgown into transparency in some places. But she was not seeing him, and at this point he doubted if her semi-nakedness mattered. She was dying.
"Johnny, bring the basin. I think I'm going to throw up," she cried.
He brought the basin out from under the bed and put it beside her, but she thrashed and knocked it onto the floor with a hollow bonging sound, which she also couldn't hear. He picked it up and just held it, watching her.
"Johnny," she screamed, "I can't find my sewing box. It isn't in the closet."
He poured her a glass of water from the pitcher on the nightstand and held it to her lips, but she thrashed again and almost knocked it from his grasp. He set it back down where it would be in reach if she quieted. He had never been so bitterly aware of his muteness as the last 2 days had made him. The Methodist minister, Braceman, had been with her on the 23rd when Nick came over. He was Bible reading with her in the living room, but he looked nervous and anxious to get away. Nick could guess why. Her fever had given her a rosy, girlish glow that went jarringly with her bereavement. Perhaps the minister had been anxious to gather up his family and melt away over the fields. News travels fast in a small town, and others had already decided to get out of Shoyo. Since the time Braceman had left the Baker living room some 48 hours ago, everything had turned into a waking nightmare. Mrs. Baker had gotten worse, so much worse that Nick had feared she would die before the sun went down. Worse, he couldn't sit with her constantly. He had gone down to the truck stop to get his three prisoners lunch, but Vince Hogan hadn't been able to eat. He was delirious. Mike Childress and Billy Warner wanted out, but Nick couldn't bring himself to let them out. It wasn't fear. He didn't believe they would waste any time working him over to settle their grievance. They would want to make fast tracks away from Shoyo like the others. But he had a responsibility. He had made a promise to a man who was now dead. Surely, sooner or later, the state patrol would get things in hand and come to take them away. He found a .45 rolled up in its holster in the bottom drawer of Baker's desk, and after a few moments of debate, he put it on. Looking down and seeing the wood-grip butt of the gun lying against his skinny hip, it made him feel ridiculous, but its weight was comforting. He had opened Vince's cell on the afternoon of the 23rd and had put makeshift ice packs on the man's forehead, chest, and neck. Vince had opened his eyes and looked at Nick with such silent, miserable appeal that Nick wished he could say anything, as he wished it now 2 days later with Mrs. Baker, anything that would give the man a moment's comfort. Just, "You'll be okay," or "I think the fever's breaking," would be enough. That afternoon, he had shuttled back and forth on nearly empty streets, always expecting to find Vince Hogan dead on one end or Jane Baker dead on the other. He looked for Dr. Soames's car, but didn't see it. That afternoon, a few of the shops had still been open, and the Texaco, but he became more and more convinced that the town was emptying out. People were taking paths through the woods, logging roads, maybe even wading up Shoyo Stream, which passed through Smackover and eventually came out in Mount Holly. More would leave after dark. The sun had just gone down when he arrived at the Baker house to find Jane moving shakily around the kitchen in her bathrobe, brewing tea. She looked at Nick gratefully when he came in, and he saw her fever was gone.
"I want to thank you for watching after me," she said calmly. "I feel ever so much better. Would you like a cup of tea?"
And then she burst into tears. He went to her, afraid she might faint or fall against the hot stove. She held his arm to steady herself and laid her head against him, her hair a dark, rich flood against the light blue robe.
"Johnny," she said in a darkening kitchen. "Oh, my poor Johnny." If he could speak, Nick thought unhappily, but he could only hold her, guide her across the kitchen to the table.
"The tea," he pointed to himself and then made her sit down.
"All right," she said. "I do feel better, remarkably so. It's just that... just..."
She put her hands over her face. Nick made them hot tea and brought it to the table. They drank for a while without speaking. She held her cup in both hands like a child. At last she put her cup down and said,
"How many in town have this, Nick?"
"I don't know anymore," Nick wrote. "It's pretty bad."
"Have you seen the doctor?"
Not since this morning. "'Am will wear himself out if he's not careful,' she said. "'He'll be careful, won't he, Nick, not to wear himself out?' Nick nodded and tried a smile. "'What about Johnny's prisoners? Has the patrol come for them?' "'No,' Nick wrote. "'Hogan is very sick. I'm doing what I can. "'The others want me to let them out before Hogan can make them sick.' "'Don't you let them out,' she said with some spirit. "'I hope you're not thinking of it.' "'No,' Nick wrote. "'You ought to be back in bed. You need rest.' She smiled at him, and when she moved her head, Nick could see the dark smudges under the angles of her jaw, and he wondered uneasily if she was out of the woods yet. "'Yes, I'm going to sleep the clock right around. It seems wrong, somehow, to sleep with John dead. I can hardly believe he is, you know. I keep stumbling over the idea like something I forgot to put away.' He took her hand and squeezed it. She smiled wanly. "'There may be something else to live for in time. "'Have you gotten your prisoners their supper, Nick?' "'Nick shook his head. "'You ought to. If you drive, why don't you take John's car?' "'I can't drive,' Nick wrote, "'but thank you. "'I'll just walk down to the truck stop. "'It isn't far. "'And check on you in the morning, if that's all right.' "'Yes,' she said, "'fine.' He got up and pointed sternly at the teacup. "'Every drop,' she promised. He was going out the screen door when he felt her hesitant touch on his arm. "'John,' she said, stopped, and then forced herself to go on. "'I hope they took him to the Curtis mortuary. "'That's where John's folks and mine have always been buried out of. "'Do you think they took him there all right?' Nick nodded, and the tears brimmed over her cheeks, and she began to sob again. When he left her that night, he had gone directly to the truck stop. A closed sign hung crookedly in the window. He had gone around to the house trailer and back, but it was locked and dark. No one answered his knock. Under the circumstances, he felt he was justified in a little breaking and entering. There would be enough in Sheriff Baker's petty cash box to pay any damages. He hammered in the glass by the restaurant's lock and let himself in. The place was spooky, even with all the lights on. The jukebox dark and dead, no one at the bumper pool table or the electronic hockey game, the booths empty, the stools unoccupied. The hood was over the grill. Nick went out back and fried some hamburgers on the gas stove and put them in a sack. He added a bottle of milk and half an apple pie that stood under a plastic dome on the counter. Then he went back to the jail, after leaving a note on the counter explaining who had broken in and why. Vince Hogan was dead. He lay on the floor of his cell amid a clutter of melting ice and wet towels. He had clawed at his neck at the end as if he had been resisting an invisible strangler. The tips of his fingers were red. Flies were lighting on him and buzzing off. His neck was black and swollen.
"'Now will you let us out?' Mike Childress asked. "'He's dead, you fucking mutie. Are you satisfied? Now he's got it, too.'
He pointed to Billy Warner. Billy looked terrified.
"'That's a lie,' he chanted hysterically. "'A lie, a lie, a fucking lie. That's a li-'
He began to sneeze suddenly, doubling over with the force of them, expelling a heavy spray of saliva and mucus.
"'See?' Mike demanded. "'Huh? You happy, you fucking mutie dimwit? Let me out. You can keep him if you want to, but not me. It's murder, that's all it is, cold-blooded murder.'
Nick shook his head, and Mike had a tantrum. He began to throw himself against the bars of his cell, bruising his face, blooding the knuckles of both hands. Nick pushed the food through the slots in the bottoms of the cells with the broom handle. Billy looked at his dully for a moment, then began to eat. Mike threw his glass of milk against the bars. It shattered, and milk sprayed everywhere. He slammed his two burgers against the graffiti-covered rear wall of his cell, and one of them stuck grotesquely in a splat of mustard, ketchup, and relish. He jumped up and down on his slice of apple pie, boogieing on it. Apple chunks flew every which way. The white plastic plate splintered.
"'I'm on a hunger strike!' he yelled. "'Fucking hunger strike! I won't eat nothing! You'll eat my dingle before I eat anything you bring me, you fucking retard asshole! You—'
Nick turned away, and silence immediately descended. He went back out into the office, not knowing what to do, scared. Perhaps he should let them go. If he could drive, he would take them up to Camden himself.
But he couldn't drive, and there was Vince to think about. He couldn't just let him lie there drawing flies. There were two doors opening off the office. One was a coat closet. The other led down a flight of stairs. Nick went down and saw it was a combination cellar and storage room. It was cool down there. He went back upstairs. Mike was sitting on the floor, morosely picking up squashed apple slices, brushing them off and eating them. He didn't look up at Nick. Nick gathered the body up in his arms and tried to lift it. The sick smell coming off the corpse was making his stomach do cartwheels and handstands. Vince was too heavy for him. He looked at the body helplessly for a moment and became aware that both of the others were now standing at their cell doors, watching with a dreadful fascination. Nick could guess what they were thinking. Vince had been one of them, a friend. He had died like a rat in a trap with some horrible swelling sickness they didn't understand. Nick wondered, not for the first time that day, when he would start to sneeze and run a fever and develop those peculiar swellings on his neck. He laid hold of Vince Hogan's meaty forearms and dragged him out of the cell. Vince's head leaned toward him because of the weight of his shoulders, and he seemed to be looking at Nick, wordlessly telling him to be careful, not to joggle him too much. It took 10 minutes to get the big man's remains down the steep stairs. Panting, Nick laid him on the concrete under the fluorescence and then covered him quickly with a frayed army blanket from the cot upstairs. He tried to sleep then, but sleep only came in the early hours of the morning after June 23rd had become the 24th, yesterday. His dreams had always been very vivid, and sometimes he was afraid of them. He rarely had out-and-out nightmares, but more and more often lately they were ominous, giving him the feeling that no one in them was exactly as they seemed, and that the normal world had skewed into a place where babies were sacrificed behind closed blinds and stupendous black machines roared on and on in locked basements. And, of course, there was the very personal terror that he would wake up with it himself. He did sleep a little, and the dream that came was one he had had before recently. The cornfield, the smell of warm growing things, the feel that something or someone very good and safe was close, a sense of home. And that began to fade into cold terror as he became aware that something was in the corn watching him. He thought, "Ma, Weasel's got in the hen house," and awoke to early morning light, sweat standing out on his body. He put coffee on and went in to check on his two prisoners. Mike Childress was in tears. Behind him, the hamburger was still stuck on the wall in its drying glue of condiments.
"You satisfied now? I got it, too. Ain't that what you wanted? Listen to me, I sound like a fucking freight train going up a hill."
But Nick's first concern had been for Billy Warner, who lay comatose on his bunk. His neck was swelled and black, his chest rising in fits and starts. He hurried back to the office, looked at the telephone, and in a fit of rage and guilt, he knocked it off the desk and onto the floor, where it lay meaninglessly at the end of its cord. He turned the hot plate off and ran down the street to the Baker house. He pushed the bell for what seemed an hour before Jane came down, wrapped in her robe. The fever sweat was back on her face. She was not delirious, but her words were slow and slurry, and her lips were blistered.
"Nick, come in. What is it?"
"V. Hogan died last night. Warner's dying, I think. He's awful sick. Have you seen doctor?" She shook her head.
"I haven't seen anyone."
She shivered in the light draft, sneezed, and then swayed on her feet. Nick put an arm around her shoulders and led her to a chair. He wrote, "Can you call his office for me?"
"Yes, of course. Bring me the phone, Nick. I seem to have had a setback in the night."
He brought the phone over, and she dialed Soames's number. After she had held the receiver to her ear for more than half a minute, he knew there was going to be no answer. She tried his home, then the home of his nurse. No answer.
"I'll try the state patrol," she said,
but put the phone back in the cradle after dialing two numbers.
"The long distance is still out of service, I guess. It just goes wah, wah, wah in my ear."
She gave him a pallid smile, and then the tears began to flow helplessly.
"Poor Nick," she said. "Poor me. Poor everybody. Could you help me upstairs? I feel so weak and I can't catch my breath. I think I'll be with John soon.
He looked at her, wishing he could speak.
I think I'll lie down if you can help me.
He helped her upstairs, then wrote, I'll be back.
Thank you, Nick. You're a good boy.
She was already drifting off to sleep. Nick left the house and stood on the sidewalk, wondering what to do next. If he could drive, he might be able to do something, but... For the next hour and a half of that morning, yesterday morning, Nick knocked on doors and rang bells. There would be someone well, he told himself. He himself felt all right, and surely he could not be the only one. There would be someone, a man, a woman, maybe a teenager with a learner's permit, and he or she would say, oh, hey, yes, let's get them to Camden. We'll take the station wagon, or words to that effect. But his knocking and ringing was answered less than a dozen times. The door would open to the length of a latch chain, a sick but hopeful face would look out, see Nick, and hope would die. The face would move back and forth in negation, and then the door would shut. If Nick could talk, he would have argued that if they could still walk, they could drive, that if they would take his prisoners to Camden, they could go themselves, and there would be a hospital. They would be made well. But he couldn't speak. Some asked if he had seen Dr. Soames. One man, in a delirious rage, threw the door of his small ranch house wide open, staggered out on the porch dressed only in his underpants, and tried to grab Nick. He said he was going to do what I should have done to you back in Houston. He seemed to think Nick was someone named Jenner. He lurched back and forth along the porch after Nick like a zombie in a third-rate horror picture. His crotch had swelled terribly. His underpants looked as if someone had stuffed a honeydew melon into them. At last he crashed to the porch, and Nick watched him from the lawn below, his heart thumping rapidly. The man shook his fist weakly, then crawled back inside, not bothering to shut the door. But most of the houses were only silent and cryptic, and at last he could do no more. That dream sense of ominousness was creeping up on him, and it became impossible to dismiss the idea that he was knocking on the doors of tombs, knocking to wake the dead, and that sooner or later the corpses might begin to answer. It didn't help much to tell himself that most of the houses were already empty, their occupants already fled to Camden or El Dorado or Texarkana. He went back to the Baker house. Jane Baker was sleeping deeply, her forehead cool, but this time he wasn't as hopeful. It was noon. Nick went back to the truck stop, feeling his night's broken rest now. Baker's 45 banged his hip. At the truck stop, he heated two cans of soup and put them in thermos jugs. The milk in the fridge still seemed fine, so he took a bottle of that, too. Billy Warner was dead, and when Mike saw Nick, he began to giggle hysterically and point his finger.
Two down and one to go. Two down and one to go, right? Right?
Nick carefully pushed the thermos of soup through the slot with the broom handle, and then a big glass of milk. Mike began to drink soup directly from the thermos in small sips. Nick took his own thermos and sat down in the hallway. He would take Billy downstairs, but first he would have his lunch. He was hungry. As he drank his soup, he looked at Mike thoughtfully.
You wondering how I am?
Mike asked. Nick nodded.
Just the same as when you left this morning. I must have hawked out a pound of snot.
He looked at Nick hopefully.
My mom always said when you hawked snot like that, you was getting better. Maybe I just got a mild case, huh?
Nick shrugged. Anything was possible.
I got the constitution of a brass eagle, Mike said. I think it's nothing. I think I'll throw it off. Listen, man, let me out, please. I'm fucking begging you now.
Nick thought about it.
Hell, you got the gun. I don't want you for nothing anyway. I just want to get out of this town. I want to check on my wife first.
Nick pointed to his left hand, which was bare of rings.
Yeah, we're divorced, but she's still here in town, out on the Ridge Road. I'd like to look in on her. What do you say, man?
Mike was crying.
Give me a chance.
Nick stood up slowly, went out into the office, and opened the desk drawer. The keys were there. The man's logic was inexorable. There was no sense in believing that someone was going to come and bail them out of this terrible mess. He got the keys and went back. He held up the one Big John Baker had shown him, with the tag of white tape on it, and tossed them through the bars to Mike Childress.
"Thanks," Mike babbled. "Oh, thanks. I'm sorry we beat up on you. I swear to God, it was Ray's idea. Me and Vince tried to stop him, but he gets drinking and he gets crazy."
He rattled the key in the lock. Nick stood back, his hand on the gun butt. The cell door opened and Mike stepped out.
"I meant it," he said. "All I want to do is get out of this town."
He sidled past Nick, a grin twitching at his lips. Then he bolted through the door between the small cell block and the office. Nick followed just in time to see the office door closing behind him. Nick went outside. Mike was standing on the curb, his hand on a parking meter, looking at the empty street.
"My God,"
he whispered, and turned his stunned face to look at Nick.
"All this? All this?"
Nick nodded, his hand still on the gun butt. Mike started to say something, and it turned into a coughing spasm. He covered his mouth, then wiped his lips.
"I'm getting the Christ out of here," he said. "You're wise, you'll do the same thing, Mutie. This is like the Black Death or something."
Nick shrugged, and Mike started down the sidewalk. He moved faster and faster until he was nearly running. Nick watched him until he was out of sight, and then went back inside. He never saw Mike again. His heart felt lighter, and he was suddenly sure that he had done the right thing. He lay down on the cot and went to sleep almost at once. He slept all afternoon on the blanketless couch and awoke sweaty, but feeling a little better. Thunderstorms were beating the hills, but none had come to Shoyo that night. At dusk, he walked down Main Street to Paulie's radio and TV and committed another of his apologetic break-ins. He left a note by the cash register and lugged a Sony portable back to the jail. He turned it on and flipped through the channels. The CBS affiliate was broadcasting a sign which read, "Microwave relay difficulty, please stay tuned." The ABC station was showing I Love Lucy, and the NBC feed was a rerun episode on a current series about a perky young girl trying to be a mechanic on the stock car circuit. The Texarkana station, an independent specializing mostly in old movies, game shows, and the PTL club, was off the air. Nick snapped it off, went down to the truck stop, and fixed enough soup and sandwiches for two. He thought there was something eerie about the way all the street lights still came on, stretching out both ways along Main Street in spotlit pools of white light. He put the food in a hamper, and on the way to Jane Baker's house, three or four dogs, obviously unfed and ravenous, advanced on him in a pack, drawn by the smell from the hamper. Nick drew the .45, but couldn't summon up the heart to use it until one of the dogs was getting ready to bite him. Then he pulled the trigger, and the bullet whined off the cement 5 feet in front of him, leaving a silvery streak of lead. The sound of the report did not come to him, but he felt the dull thud of vibration. The dogs broke and ran. Jane was asleep, her forehead and cheeks hot, her breathing slow and labored. She looked dreadfully wasted to Nick. He got a cold washcloth and wiped her face. He left her share of food on the night table and then went down into the living room and turned on the Baker's TV, a big console color job. CBS didn't come on all night. NBC kept to a regular broadcast schedule, but the picture on the ABC affiliate kept going hazy, sometimes fading out to snow and then snapping back suddenly. The ABC channel showed only old syndication programs, as if its line to the network had been severed. It didn't matter. What Nick was waiting for was the news. When it came on, he was dumbfounded. The super flu epidemic, as it was now being called, was the lead story, but the newscasters on both stations said it was being brought under control. A flu vaccine had been developed at the Atlanta Center for Disease Control, and you could get the shot from your doctor by early the following week. Outbreaks were reportedly serious in New York, San Francisco, L.A., and London, but all were being contained. In some areas, the newscaster went on, public gatherings had been canceled temporarily. In Shoyo, Nick thought, the entire town had been canceled. Who was kidding who? The newscaster concluded by saying that travel to most of the large city areas was still restricted, but the restrictions would be lifted as soon as the vaccine was in general release. He went on to a plane crash in Michigan and some congressional reactions to the Supreme Court's gay rights decision. Nick turned off the TV and went out onto the Baker's porch. There was a glider, and he sat down in it. The back-and-forth motion was soothing, and he couldn't hear the rusty squeak that John Baker kept forgetting to oil. He watched fireflies as they hemmed irregular seams in the dark. Lightning flashed dully inside the clouds on the horizon, making them look as if they held fireflies of their own, monster fireflies the size of dinosaurs. The night was sticky and close. Because television was a completely visual medium for Nick, he had noticed something about the news broadcast that others might have missed. There had been no film clips, none at all. There had been no baseball scores, maybe because no ball games had been played. A vague weather report and no weather map showing the highs and lows, it was as if the U.S. Bureau of Meteorology had closed up shop. For all Nick knew to the contrary, they had. Both newscasters had seemed nervous and upset. One of them had a cold. He had coughed once on mic and had excused himself. Both newscasters had kept cutting their eyes to the left and right of the camera they were facing, as if someone was in the studio with them, someone who was there to make sure they got it right. That was the night of June 24th, and he slept raggedly on the baker's front porch, and his dreams were very bad. And now, on the afternoon of the following day, he was officiating at the death of Jane Baker, this fine woman, and he couldn't say a word to comfort her. Nick put his forehead against the glass of the window that looked out on the deserted, sun-struck town, and cried his tears of fear and sorrow. He was afraid to look behind him, because her harsh struggle to breathe had ended. Now, except for the beat of his own heart, not heard but felt in his temples, this bedroom was as silent as the rest of Shoyo, Arkansas. Chapter 20. In Duluth, a man in khaki shorts and sandals walked up and down Piedmont Avenue with a large smear of ash on his forehead and a hand-lettered sandwich board hanging over his scrawny shoulders. The front read, "The time of the disappearance is here. Christ the Lord returneth soon. Prepare to meet your God." The back read, "Behold, the hearts of the sinners were broken. The great shall be abased and the abased made great. The evil days are at hand. Woe to thee, O Zion!" Four young men in motorcycle jackets, all of them with bad coughs and runny noses, set upon the man in the khaki shorts and beat him unconscious with his own sandwich board. Then they fled, one of them calling back hysterically over his shoulder, "Teach you to scare people! Teach you to scare people, you half-baked freak!" The highest-rated morning program in Springfield, Missouri, was KLFT's morning phone-in show, Speak Your Peace, with Ray Flowers. He had six phone lines into his studio booth, and on the morning of June 26th, he was the only KLFT employee to show up for work. He was aware of what was going on in the world outside, and it scared him. In the last week or so, it seemed to Ray that everyone he knew had come down sick. There were no troops in Springfield, but he had heard that the National Guard had been called into KC and St. Louis to stop the spread of panic and prevent looting. Ray Flowers himself felt fine. He looked thoughtfully at his equipment, phones, time-delay device, racks of commercials on cassettes. "If your toilet overflows and you don't know just what goes, call for the man with the big steel hose, call your clean-out man." And, of course, the mic. He lit a cigarette, went to the studio door and locked it, went into his booth and locked that. He turned off the canned music that had been playing from a tape reel, turned on his own theme music, and then settled in at the microphone. "Hi, y'all," he said. "This is Ray Flowers on Speak Your Peace. And this morning, I guess there's only one thing to call about, isn't there? You can call it Tube Neck or Superflu or Captain Trips, but it all means the same thing. I've heard some horror stories about the Army clamping down on everything, and if you want to talk about that, I'm ready to listen. It's still a free country, right? And since I'm here by myself this morning, we're going to do things just a little bit differently. I've got the time delay turned off, and I think we can dispense with the commercials. If the Springfield you're seeing is anything like the one I'm seeing from the KLFT windows, no one feels much like shopping anyway. So if you're supposed to be up and around, as my mother used to say, let's get going. Our toll-free numbers are 656-8600 and 656-8601. If you get a busy, just be patient. Remember, I'm doing it all myself." There was an Army unit in Carthage, 50 miles from Springfield, and a 20-man patrol was dispatched to take care of Ray Flowers. Two men refused the order. They were shot on the spot. In the hour it took them to get to Springfield, Ray Flowers took calls from a doctor who said people were dying like flies and who thought the government was lying through its teeth about a vaccine, a hospital nurse who confirmed that bodies were being removed from Kansas City hospitals by the truckload, a delirious woman who claimed it was flying saucers from outer space, a farmer who said that an army squad with two payloaders had just finished digging a hell of a long ditch in a field near Route 71 south of Kansas City, half a dozen others with their own stories to tell. Then there was a crashing sound on the outer studio door. "Open up," a muffled voice cried. "Open up in the name of the United States." Ray looked at his watch. 11:45. "Well," he said, "it looks like the Marines have landed. But we'll just keep taking calls, shall we?" There was a rattle of automatic rifle fire, and the knob of the studio door fell to the rug. Blue smoke drifted out of the ragged hole. The door was shouldered inward, and half a dozen soldiers, wearing respirators and full battle dress, burst in. "Several soldiers have just broken into the outer office," Ray said. "They're fully armed. They look like they're ready to start a mop-up operation in France 36 years ago, except for the respirators on their faces." "Shut it down," a heavy-set man with sergeant stripes on his sleeves yelled. He loomed outside the broadcast booth's glass walls and gestured with his rifle. "I think not," Ray called back. He felt very cold, and when he fumbled his cigarette out of his ashtray, he saw that his fingers were trembling. "This station is licensed by the FCC, and I'm revoking your fucking license. Now shut down." "I think not," Ray said again, and turned back to his microphone. "Ladies and gentlemen, I've been ordered to shut down, and I have refused the order quite properly, I think. These men are acting like Nazis, not American soldiers. I am not..." "Last chance." The sergeant brought his gun up. "Sergeant," one of the soldiers by the door said, "I don't think you can just..." "If that man says anything else, waste him," the sergeant said. "I think they're going to shoot me," Ray Flowers said, and the next moment the glass of his broadcast booth blew inward, and he fell over his control panel. From somewhere there came a terrific feedback whine that spiraled up and up. The sergeant fired his entire clip into the control panel, and the feedback cut off. The lights on the switchboard continued to blink. "Okay," the sergeant said, turning around. "I want to get back to Carthage by 1 o'clock, and I don't..." Three of his men fired simultaneously, one of them with a recoilless rifle that fired 70 gas-tipped slugs per second. The sergeant did a jigging, shuffling death dance, and then fell backward through the shattered remains of the broadcast booth's glass wall. One leg spasmed, and his combat boot kicked shards of glass from the frame. A PFC, pimple standing out in stark relief on his whey-colored face, burst into tears. The others only stood in stunned disbelief. The smell of cordite was heavy and sickening in the air.
"We scragged him," the PFC cried hysterically. "Holy God, we done scragged Sergeant Buchan!"
No one replied. Their faces were still dazed and uncomprehending, although later they would only wish they had done it sooner. All of this was some deadly game, but it wasn't their game. The phone, which Ray Flowers had put in the amplifier cradle just before he died, gave out a series of squawks.
"Ray? You there, Ray?"
The voice was tired, nasal.
"I listen to your program all the time, me and my husband both, and we just want to say keep up the good work and don't let them bully you. Okay, Ray? Ray? Ray?"
In Boulder, Colorado, a rumor that the U.S. Meteorological Air Testing Center was really a biological warfare installation began to spread. The rumor was repeated on the air by a semi-delirious Denver FM disc jockey. By 11 p.m. on the night of June 26, the vast, lemming-like exodus from Boulder had begun. A company of soldiers was sent out from Denver, Arvada, to stop them, but it was like sending a man with a whisk broom to clean out the Augean stables. Better than 11,000 civilians, sick, scared, and with no other thought but to put as many miles between themselves and the air testing center as possible, rolled over them. Thousands of other Boulderites fled to other points of the compass. At 11:15, a shattering explosion lit the night at the air testing center's location on Broadway. A young radical named Desmond Ramage had planted better than 16 pounds of plastique, originally earmarked for various Midwestern courthouses and state legislatures, in the ATC lobby. The explosive was great. The timer was cruddy. Ramage was vaporized, along with all sorts of harmless weather equipment and particle-for-particle pollution measuring gadgets. Meanwhile, the exodus from Boulder went on. Chapter 21. Larry Underwood sat on a bench in Central Park on the morning of June 27th, looking into the menagerie. Behind him, Fifth Avenue was crazily jammed with cars, all of them silent now, their owners dead or fled. Further down Fifth, many of the posh shops were smoking rubble. From where Larry sat, he could see a lion, an antelope, a zebra, and some sort of monkey. All but the monkey were dead. They had not died of the flu, Larry judged. They had gotten no food or water for God knew how long, and that had killed them. All but the monkey, and in the 3 hours that Larry had been sitting there, the monkey had only moved 4 or 5 times. The monkey had been smart enough to outwit starvation or death by thirst, so far. But it surely had a good case of superflu. That was one monkey who was hurting for certain. It was a hard old world. To his right, the clock with all the animals chimed the hour of 11. The clockwork figures, which had once delighted all children, now played to an empty house. The bear tooted his horn. A clockwork monkey who would never get sick, but who might eventually run down, played a tambourine. The elephant beat his drum with his trunk. Heavy tunes, baby, heavy fucking tunes. End of the world suite arranged for clockwork figures. After a bit, the clock silenced, and he could hear the horse shouting again, now mercifully faint with distance. The monster shouter was now off to Larry's left, perhaps in the Heckscher playground. Maybe he would fall into the wading pool there and drown.
"Monster's coming,"
the faint hoarse voice cried. The overcast had broken this morning, and the day was bright and hot. A bee cruised past Larry's nose, circled one of the nearby flower beds, and made a 3-point landing on a peony. From the menagerie came the soothing, soporific drone of the flies as they landed on the dead animals.
"Monster's coming now,"
the monster shouter called. The monster shouter was a tall man in his mid-60s, Larry judged. He had first heard the monster shouter the night before, which he had spent in the Sherry Netherland. With night lying over the unnaturally quiet city, the faint howling voice had seemed sonorous and dark, the voice of a lunatic Jeremiah floating through the streets of Manhattan, echoing, rebounding, distorting. Larry, lying sleepless in a queen-sized double, with every light in the suite blazing, had become irrationally convinced that the monster shouter was coming for him, seeking him out, the way the creatures of his frequent bad dreams sometimes did. For a long time, it had seemed that the voice was drawing ever closer.
"Monster's coming! Monster's on the way! They're in the suburbs!"
And Larry became convinced that the suite's door, which he had triple locked, would burst inward, and that the monster shouter would be there. Not a human being at all, but a gigantic troll thing with the head of a dog and saucer-sized fly eyes and champing teeth. But this morning Larry had seen him in the park, and it was only a crazy old man wearing corduroy pants and zoris and horn-rimmed glasses with one bow taped. Larry had tried to speak to him, and the monster shouter had run in terror, crying back over his shoulder that the monsters would be in the streets at any moment. He had tripped over an ankle-high wire fence and went sprawling on one of the bike pads, his glasses flying off but not shattering. Larry had gone to him, but before he could get there, the monster shouter had scooped up his glasses and was gone toward the mall, crying his endless warning. So Larry's opinion of him had swung from extreme terror to utter boredom and mild annoyance in the space of 12 hours. There were other people in the park, and Larry had spoken to a few. They were all pretty much the same, and Larry supposed that he himself wasn't much different. They were dazed, their speech disjointed. They seemed helpless to stop reaching for your sleeve with their hands as they talked. They had stories to tell. All the stories were the same. Their friends and relatives were dead or dying. There had been shooting in the streets. There had been the big fire on Fifth Avenue. Was it true that Tiffany's was gone? Could that be true? Who was going to clean up? Who was going to collect the garbage? Should they get out of New York? They had heard the troops were guarding all the points of egress. One woman was terrified that the rats were going to rise up out of the subways and inherit the earth. reminding Larry uneasily of his own thoughts on the day he had first returned to New York. A young man munching Fritos from a gigantic bag told Larry conversationally that he was going to fulfill a lifetime ambition. He was going to Yankee Stadium, run around the outfield naked, and then masturbate on home plate. "Chance of a lifetime, man," he told Larry, winked with both eyes, and then wandered off eating Fritos. Many of the people in the park were sick, but not many had died there. Perhaps they had uneasy thoughts of being munched for dinner by the animals, and they had crawled indoors when they felt the end was near. Larry had had only one confrontation with death this morning, and one was all he wanted. He had walked up transverse number 1 to the comfort station there. He had opened the door, and a grinning dead man with maggots crawling briskly hither and yon on his face had been seated inside, his hands settled on his bare thighs, his sunken eyes staring into Larry's own. A sickening sweet smell bloated out at Larry, as if the man sitting there was a rancid bonbon, a sweet treat which, in all the confusion, had been left for the flies. Larry slammed the door to, but belatedly. He lost the cornflakes he'd eaten for breakfast, and then had dry-heaved until he was afraid he might rupture some of his inner workings. "God, if you're there," he had prayed as he stumbled back toward the menagerie, "if you're taking requests today, big fella, mine is not to have to look at anything else like that today. The kooks are bad enough. Something like that is more than I can take. Thank you so much." Now, sitting on this bench, the monster shouter had moved out of earshot, at least temporarily, Larry found himself thinking about the World Series 5 years ago, when Cincinnati had played and bested the Boston Red Sox. It was good to remember that because, it now seemed to him, that was the last time he had been completely happy, his physical condition tip-top, his mind resting easily and not working against itself. That had been just after he and Rudy split. That had been a damn piss-poor thing, that split-up. And if he ever saw Rudy again, never happened, his mind told him with a sigh, Larry was going to apologize. He would get down and kiss Rudy's shoe-tops, if that was what Rudy needed to make it okay again. They had worked their way across the country, and for a while they worked on a farm in western Nebraska, and one night Larry had lost $60 in a poker game. The next day he'd had to ask Rudy for a loan to tide him over. They had arrived in L.A. a month later, and Larry had been the first to land a job, if you wanted to call washing dishes for the minimum wage working. One night, 3 weeks later, Rudy had broached the subject of the loan. He said he'd met a guy who'd recommended a really good employment agency, never miss, but the fee was $25. Which happened to be the amount of the loan he had made to Larry after the poker game. Ordinarily, Rudy said, he never would have asked, but... Larry had protested that he'd paid the loan back. They were square. If Rudy wanted the 25, okay, but he just hoped Rudy wasn't trying to get him to pay off the same loan twice. Rudy said he didn't want a gift, he wanted the money he was owed. And he wasn't interested in a lot of Larry Underwood bullshit either. "Jesus Christ," Larry said, trying a good-humored laugh. "I never thought I'd need a receipt from you, Rudy. Guess I was wrong." It had escalated into a full-scale argument, almost to the point of blows. At the end, Rudy's face had been flushed. "That's you, Larry," he'd shouted. "That's you all over. That's how you are. I used to think I'd never learn my lesson, but I think I finally did. Fuck off, Larry." Rudy left, and Larry followed him to the stairs of the cheap rooming house, digging his wallet out of his back pocket. There were 3 tens neatly folded into the secret compartment behind the photos, and he had heaved them after Rudy. "Go on, you cheap little lying fuck. Take it. Take the goddamn money." Rudy had slammed the outer door open with a bang and had gone out into the night, toward whatever destiny the Rudys of this world can expect. He didn't look back. Larry had stood at the top of the stairs, breathing hard, and after a minute or so he had gathered up his 3 $10 bills and put them away again. Thinking of the incident now and then over the years, he had become more and more sure that Rudy had been right. Actually, he was positive. Even if he had paid Rudy back, the two of them had been friends since grade school, and it seemed, looking back, that Larry had always been a dime short for the Saturday matinee because he'd bought some licorice whips or a couple of candy bars on the way over to Rudy's, or borrowing a nickel to round out his school lunch money or getting 7 cents to make up car fare. Over the years, he must have bummed $50 in change from Rudy, maybe 100.
When Rudy had braced him for that 25, Larry could remember the way he had tightened up. His brain had subtracted $25 from the 3 tens and had said to him, "That only leaves $5. Therefore, you already paid him back. I'm not sure just when, but you did. Let's have no more discussion of the matter." And no more there had been. He realized he was crying a little bit, and he felt a momentary disgust that he should be sitting here on a bench in Central Park, crying in the sun like some wretched old man on a pension. Then it occurred to him that he had a right to cry for the things he had lost, that he had a right to be in shock, if that was what this was. His mother had died 3 days ago. She had been lying on a cot in the hallway of Mercy Hospital when she died, crammed in with thousands of others who were also busy dying. Larry had been kneeling beside her when she went, and he had thought he might go mad, watching his mother die while all around him rose the stench of urine and feces, the hell's babble of the delirious, the choking, the insane, the screams of the bereaved. She hadn't known him at the end. There had been no final moment of recognition. Her chest had finally just stopped in mid-heave and had settled very slowly, like the weight of an automobile settling down on a flat tire. He had crouched beside her for 10 minutes or so, not knowing what to do, thinking in a confused way that he ought to wait until a death certificate was signed or someone asked him what had happened. But it was obvious what had happened. It was happening everywhere. It was just as obvious that the place was a madhouse. No sober young doctor was going to come along, express sympathy, and then start the machinery of death. Sooner or later, his mother would just be carried away like a sack of oats, and he didn't want to watch that. Her purse was under the cot. He found a pen and a bobby pin and her checkbook. He tore a deposit slip from the back of her book and wrote on it her name, her address, and after a moment's subtraction, her age. He clipped it to her blouse pocket with the bobby pin and began to cry. He kissed her cheek and fled, crying. He felt like a deserter. Being on the street had been a little better, although at that time the streets had been full of crazy people, sick people, and circling army patrols. And now he could sit on this bench and grieve for more general things. His mother's loss of her retirement, the loss of his own career, for that time in L.A. when he had sat watching the Reds play the Bo Sox, knowing that there would be a bed and love later, and for Rudy. Most of all, he grieved for Rudy and wished he had paid Rudy his $25 with a grin and a shrug, saving the 6 years that had been lost. The monkey died at 11:45. It was on its perch, just sitting there apathetically with its hands drawn up under its chin, and then its eyelids fluttered and it fell forward and hit the cement with a final horrid smack. Larry didn't want to sit there anymore. He got up and began to walk aimlessly down toward the mall with its large band shell. He had heard the monster shouter some 15 minutes ago, very far away, but now the only sound in the park seemed to be his own heels clicking on the cement and the twitter of the birds. Birds apparently didn't catch the flu. Good for them. When he neared the band shell, he saw that a woman was sitting on one of the benches in front of it. She was maybe 50, but had taken great pains to look younger. She was dressed in expensive-looking gray-green slacks and a silk off-the-shoulder peasant blouse. Except, Larry thought, as far as he knew, peasants can't afford silk. She looked around at the sound of Larry's footsteps. She held a pill in one hand and tossed it casually into her mouth like a peanut. "Hi," Larry said. Her face was calm, her eyes blue. Sharp intelligence gleamed in them. She was wearing gold-rimmed glasses, and her pocketbook was trimmed with something that certainly looked like mink. There were 4 rings on her fingers, a wedding band, 2 diamonds, and a cat's eye emerald. "I'm not dangerous," he said. It was a ridiculous thing to say, he supposed, but she looked like she might be wearing about $20,000 on her fingers. Of course, they might be fakes, but she didn't look like a woman who would have much use for zircons. "No," she said. "You don't look dangerous. You're not sick, either." Her voice rose a little on the last word, making her statement into a polite half-question. She wasn't as calm as she looked at first glance. There was a little tick working on the side of her neck, and behind the light of intelligence in the blue eyes was the same dull shock that Larry had seen in his own eyes this morning as he shaved. "No, I don't think I am. Are you?" "Not at all. Did you know you have an ice cream wrapper on your shoe?
He looked down and saw that he did. It made him blush because he suspected that she would have informed him that his fly was open in that same tone. He stood on one leg and tried to pull it off.
You look like a stork, she said. Sit down and try it. My name is Rita Blakemore.
Pleased to know you. I'm Larry Underwood. He sat down. She offered her hand, and he shook it lightly, his fingers pressing against her rings. Then he gingerly removed the ice cream wrapper from his shoe and dropped it primly into a can beside the bench that said, "It's your park, so keep it clean." It struck him funny, the whole operation. He threw his head back and laughed. It was the first real laugh since the day he had come home to find his mother lying on the floor of her apartment, and he was enormously relieved to find that the good feel of laughing hadn't changed. Rita Blakemore was smiling both at him and with him, and he was struck again by her casual yet elegant handsomeness.